There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free. And things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hey, everybody. I want to remind you to check out OmegaCon, which will be taking place in March this year in Birmingham, Alabama. It's going to be an amazing time. It is a sci-fi, paranormal, fantasy convention. There's going to be fantastic guest speakers. I know Jason and Grant are going to be there from Ghost Hunters. Chris Fleming will be there. Patrick Burns is going to be there. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is going to be out there. I believe Michelle Bellinger, the vampire and author, will be out there. There are just a plethora of fantastic speakers that will be joining in on hand. The Wyrick family, I believe, is added. We just had them out at Ghost Stock 2 weeks ago and had a chance to meet with those lovely ladies and hear their live story. So there's a lot of fantastic things going on. You can check out at OmegaCon. So give it a look. And it takes place in Birmingham, Alabama, March of 2008, and we will have a link for it up on our site as well, so you can click that link and join in on all the fun. We're going to get back into speaking with our guest right now, and we're talking to Craig Hines, who's written a book called Gateway of the Gods. It's a book that's out, and let me ask you now, Craig, this book is available everywhere, all major booksellers?
Sure, yeah. They can order from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders. Any bookstore can get it. If it isn't on the shelf, just ask them to order it, and they can get it for you.
All right, great. And again, it's Gateway of the Gods by Craig Hines, H-I-N-E-S. We do have a link for it up on our site, and if you click the book, it'll actually take you to where you can order a copy for yourself. So check that out at darknessradio.com and click on the show tab. Now, talk to me, Craig. What was your plan with this book? What were you hoping to share with people? What was the insight that you felt was so important for people to know with this book?
Well, as I said, whenever I was doing the research, I noticed all these parallels between the different books that I was reading, but no one else seemed to be putting it together in quite the same way. I don't know whether they just didn't see the thread connecting at all or not, and so it was really my goal to just put together this comprehensive book showing everything that I found and to put in all the research that I felt was sort of lacking in some of the other books. Like, I know, for instance, it was very frustrating for me. I would read in some other books where it's talking about the Nephilim or the Watchers, but it would tell you, like, oh, they're called the Watchers, but then it never went into any more description, or it didn't actually give you the cuneiform symbols or the Egyptian hieroglyphics. And so I would try to track down as much of that information as I could, and so then once I found it, I would incorporate it into the book because I wanted it to be sort of a go-to reference for everyone where they can look and say, yeah, that's the exact symbol that was used by the ancient Sumerians or by the Egyptians, or that's the Maya symbol for this. Or, you know, so I tried to incorporate as much as I could in there so that everyone would have the most comprehensive book on these topics as I could put out.
What part or what aspect of the paranormal interests you the most?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I have to say I'm very interested in the whole the ghost investigating and the EVP because I think that's definitely the closest thing that we can evaluate right now. Like these ancient gateways and everything, I think it's very important. But until we can start actually proving that these other dimensions exist, or we can start testing for the monatomic white gold and if it really does have these interdimensional properties, we're not going to get anywhere with that. But I think that, like, the EVPs, if it fits with that hyperspace view of it's a bleed-through from these other realms, that's something that we're currently picking up that scientists can scrutinize and we can develop more technology and methods of testing that. And if they can prove that it is a bleed-through from these other dimensions, then scientists will start taking the other claims more seriously that there might be beings existing in these other realms that we can tap into.
I think, there was a Gallup poll done in 2005 that says that 37% of Americans believe in ghosts. And there was a more recent survey that just stated that only 7% of the United States public, 7%, does not believe in the supernatural in one way, shape, or another. UFOs, ghosts, ESP, things like that. There's such a heightened belief and understanding of this. There's so much more activity that seems to be reported. Why isn't somebody dethroning the Amazing Randy and being able to give actual credible evidence of proof of the paranormal in one way or another?
Well, I know whenever I was talking to Joshua Warren the other night, in the following hour, he was talking about some of that. And he actually brought up about how if you read some of the requirements, if you are to take the Amazing Randy's test, not too many people can actually pass the test because they have to have one of the first requirements is that you need to have an established media presence. So that now I know Randy does that so that he doesn't have hundreds of thousands of people all applying. It has to be somebody who's out there in the public and says that they have these abilities. So it's to limit how many people actually apply. But that also means that any legitimate person that doesn't have a media presence but might actually have an ability like they're claiming can't, enter and take part in this test. And I forget, there was a few other things that Joshua went over, but, I mean, somebody like Randy, they serve a very good purpose. We need people out there that are highly skeptical of the claims and that can debunk these things. But it's just, I think that sometimes they get a little too skeptical in that they're sort of forgetting, they're filtering everything through their own point of view. And so, for instance, like somebody like Randy, who is an avowed atheist, he has a lot of problems with the way most people view like God and the typical like Christian point of view of what God is. And so whenever he's out there trying to debunk something like that, he's taking the views of what most established Christians believe, which, as I've pointed out in many other cases, isn't necessarily what the ancient texts actually describe. That's just what most modern people believe because they've had a lot of the context clues removed. And so I think that if somebody like Randy actually spent more time studying the ancient texts themselves, then they might be able to start taking a better look at this, and they can still apply their skeptical skills to it, but they wouldn't necessarily have such a mean streak as far as debunking some of these really wild claims.
Right. Well, I've just had a hard time understanding. I mean, there's so many people that claim to have so many abilities. And the thing that I always find so funny is, that they'll stand on the sidelines and bitch and moan about a guy like the Amazing Randy and say that, how horrible he is for the field and there's nothing you could do to prove to the guy. But then on the other side of it, they refuse to, well, why should I test myself? I already know I'm a psychic. I already know I have these abilities and I don't need to prove to anybody. Well,
yeah.
I mean, being skeptical myself, and I have good friends, that believe themselves to be psychic and medium and refuse to take the tests or do anything along those lines. And I understand that there is a certain level of wrong, being wrong, just like in every job. Some things don't come through as clearly as we'd hoped or whatever. But the fact of the whole, why do I need to prove myself? Well, because if you're going to make claims of this stature and they're going to be putting yourself out there and asking people to believe in you and give you money to give you advice based on what God or the spirits or dead Grandpa Joe is telling you, there should be some credibility given to that. So as you said, I mean, I can see some credence to what he does, but I also think that a lot is held over the heads of the people out there that claim that they don't need to prove anything to him because, as Randy says, well, that's just silly. If I'm such a hated man, you would think people would be lined up to take my money.
Oh, definitely. And I do think one other thing that Joshua Warren brought up, which I think is a valid point, is that, with that, you get $1 million. And everyone's like, ooh, $1 million is a lot of money. But he said, like, if you're truly psychic or something like that, you can win multi-million dollars if you actually won the lottery.
Right.
So the people that might actually have those abilities, they'd have a better chance and not have to go through all the legal hassles as they do with Randy because, I know whenever you take the test, they basically own your name for the following 4 years. So if they can like debunk you or disprove you somehow, they're for the next 4 years, you can't sue them, you can't do anything, which, I mean, rightfully so if you're making claims that you can't prove. But what Joshua was saying was simply that it's much easier for somebody, if they actually have those abilities, to win the lottery than to pass his test. So if they're really just concerned about getting the money, then they'd go for the easy money. But yeah, I do think that Randy serves a very good purpose. I don't always agree with everything, you know, that he says or his views, but I also highly respect Michael Shermer, publisher of Skeptic Magazine.
Right.
And I like his attitude a little bit more because, I mean, he isn't so much of, at times, Randy gets mean-spirited about things. And so with Shermer, he's a little bit more laid back, and he's just like, look, we're just trying to understand, and we're trying to replace bad ideas with good ideas.
Right, and I do understand that, and I give credence on both sides of the fight. It's just kind of a, you know, I would think that with all of our technology that we've come up with over the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, that by now there should be something that's, you know, so easy to understand and to, you know, prove the existence of this stuff. But it seems a lot more people are going out of their way to use the better, higher technology to spoof people than they are to actually go out and try to capture stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, though, too, like I said, even with everything that we learn about physics, we still don't have a whole understanding of gravity. But that's something that's just so common, and we deal with it every day. You know, or as I was explaining earlier about imagining an apple floating in front of your eyes. I mean, so many people take something like that for granted because they use it every day with their imagination or thinking thoughts to themselves. And but they don't think anything more of it. They don't actually think, well, wait, could this have hyperspace implications? And so I think so many people are sort of just out of touch with realizing that there's so much more to investigate. Like even the scientists, they don't know a lot about consciousness and how the mind actually works. They can tell you exactly how the brain works, but they don't know how your mind works. And that does seem to be a very separate element from the physical organ, which is your brain.
Let's talk about another thing that you mentioned in your book. You talk about this environmental disaster that scientists are warning about, and that it could be coming around the corner at any time now. Now, something I do kind of a little funny with that is the fact that every generation since Christ has said that was the final generation, that things were lining up and that we were finally going to reach the rapture and the Armageddon and end times. I mean, I guess if we keep saying that, eventually one of our groups is going to be right, right?
Yeah, eventually. And I even bring that up in there, how the modern view of the rapture doesn't, like, that's just sort of modern beliefs, and it's not really the actual authentic ancient biblical beliefs. But as far as the environmental end of it, I do think that it's something where we have the actual scientific evidence that events like the global warming and massive flooding and stuff have happened in the past, in events where nearly all life on Earth went extinct. So we know that that's happened. We found the fossils. We found
right.
The different evidence trapped in the ice cores, showing that they can measure how much like the CO2 was in there and different stuff. So we actually have evidence as a record of what happened. And to think that that'll never happen to us, I think is just insane, because of course it's going to happen at some point. I mean, tomorrow we could be hit by a huge asteroid that our telescopes just weren't pointed towards, and so they completely missed it, you know, coming our way.
Well, thanks for that happy thought, Craig. Good night, sir.
Oh, you're welcome. But it's the truth, and so, you know, it's one of those things where I really think that we need to take these environmental disaster scenarios seriously, but we can't be swept up and just lose all hope and do nothing about it. And we can't necessarily just start dishing out all our money to, like, whoever claims that they have the solution or something. We always have to be skeptical about it, and we have to evaluate the evidence. And so if we know that this stuff has happened in the past, then there's a very good chance it's going to happen in the future. The problem is that this time could be the time where we all get wiped out. Now, where that ties into my research is that, according to the ancient texts, they did say that it would happen again. And the difference is that in the past, what our ancestors told us was that they had the help of the gods. They were there to help them rebuild civilization and everything like that. But if this happens again, basically we're on our own, because we're told that the gateways were shut off, that we don't have access to any of that, and essentially it's our duty to learn how to do this. If we expect to take the next rank in our so-called evolution, you know, we have to prove that we have what it takes to earn that kind of status. And so whenever this disaster, you know, is looming in front of us here, we have to actually do something. And with the idea of recreating these gateways, I think it could be something where instead of the entire population of the world being wiped out, we could simply evacuate the entire planet with something as simply as walking through a doorway.
Hmm. All right. So you do give credence to these superstorms, though? You think that they are coming again? I mean, a couple of years ago when Katrina hit and all these other massive storms, you know, the tsunami, all these things that just kind of jumped up and bit us in the ass and nobody was ready for them. You know, do you think that that was a sign of what's to come? Have we just started now dealing with this?
Well, yeah, it comes and goes in cycles. Like, everyone was expecting it to be another really bad year the following year, and then it wasn't quite as bad. But then what they failed to realize is that that was just, like, in the Atlantic region. But then, from what I remember in the news stories, the Pacific region, they actually had very severe storms and everything for 2006. So it comes and goes, but then I think people, they only pay attention. It's like, well, we didn't have another Hurricane Katrina in 2006, but so they weren't paying attention to what was happening in maybe the Philippines. You know, so it moves around the globe in cycles, and I do think that I know I've come across listening to Whitley Strieber. I like the way that he says it, where nature is nothing but math. And so whenever, like, you have an increase in one aspect, it wants to balance itself out. And so whenever you increase one area, then the severity of the reaction is going to try to equalize everything. And so I think that that is a lot of it with these superstorms, that there could be something like that on its way, because as our environment and the climate grows, you know, further out of control, it's just going to become more chaotic.
We've got a lot, you know, I mean, it seems like a lot of people start talking about that. I mean, what can we do now, do you believe, as a civilization to help stave off these effects? Or is it just something that just is coming and it has nothing to do with the aerosol cans we're using or the amount of garbage or shit that we're pumping into the air?
Well, I think that we definitely have a part in it. As I said, I think it's also a natural cycle. But even if it was completely a natural cycle, because that's what everyone gets arguing about right now, is whether or not man's doing it and stuff. And my argument is, it doesn't matter whether or not we're actually causing it. It's that we are the only ones that actually have the capability of doing something about it. You know, nature itself, if it's a completely natural cycle, it's going to do it on its own. But we have the resources and technology to know that, like, okay, if we don't put as much CO2, then it's not going to be as severe. So we can actually limit ourselves in what we do. You know, so that if a volcano goes off and pumps out a lot of CO2, there's nothing we can do about that. But if there's something where we can do, like carpooling or just reducing the amount of emissions that we put forth into the atmosphere, that's something that we have control over.
Okay. Let's continue kind of talking about the different things. You know, one thing that's kind of interesting as well is when you're talking about the beginning with the religion and all the stories that are shared across the globe in places that there was just no way for these stories to be passed, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one story that strikes me is the story of the Great Flood with Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
Every religion, it seems, and every belief system seems to have a version of the story of the Ark and of the Flood.
Definitely. I mean, even whenever you come over to the Americas and you have the Native Americans that tell the same story about how some of them had to go to the mountains because the waters rose so high, or that they, and again, they said that, like, these spirit beings, the Kachinas, were the ones that came to their rescue. But again, they're talking about spirit beings, but they're also talking about spirit beings that are there in the flesh and blood. So I think, time and time again, it's very interesting that they're talking about these same white-skinned, white-haired beings, whether you're in the Mesopotamian region or you move up to Europe and you're talking about elves, or, you know, you move down to South America and they're talking about Quetzalcoatl and the other gods. You find time and time again that you have these ancient myths where it talks about an environmental disaster, particularly like global flooding, and that they had these gods there to help them and to help them rebuild civilization after everything was destroyed.
Right. Well, we're going to take our break here for the second hour. We're going to be right back. You're listening to The Darkness on the Edge of Town. We're here with you every Sunday night from 10 to midnight. You can listen live. And if you can't tune in live, make sure to tune in the show by going to our archives where you can download the show and listen to it anytime. We're also back on iTunes. You can just go to Planet Paranormal, click on The Darkness Radio, and subscribe. Then you'll never miss an episode. We'll be back with more right after this.
In the light, you'll understand why we must return to The Darkness on the Edge of Town. Stay tuned. There is more to come.
For 58 years, Fate has consistently supplied its loyal readership with a broad array of true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate is a factual magazine containing articles by experts in all walks of life, and by others just like you who have something dynamic, significant, and truthful to say. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, archaeological hotspots, alternative science, and much, much more. To receive your free Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Are you tired of reading about what couple in Hollywood is breaking up or divorcing? Have you ever wondered where you can find the news that covers the subjects that you are really interested in? I would like to invite you to visit SupernaturalNews.com. Supernatural News uses the latest internet technology to search for the topics we know you will be interested in reading. News of the latest Bigfoot, UFO, or Loch Ness monster sightings. Read about the latest conspiracy theories and urban legends. Supernatural News, where belief and reality merge.
When Dave was a young boy, he once awoke to find himself staring directly into the eyes of a shadow person. Turns out it was just his life-size cardboard cutout of Donny Osmond.
Go away and go. Go away and go.
Welcome back to The Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Hey, welcome back to the show. You're listening to Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. And my name is Dave Schrader. My co-host is, as always, Mr. Tim Dennis. Tim, you had a question during the break. You wanted to talk, you wanted to mention to Craig. Go ahead and I'll throw you up that with the cryptozoological point.
Well, Craig, it's, I mean, we've covered a lot in the paranormal spectrum over the last hour and a half or so. But the one thing that I'm interested in is how cryptozoology figures into your theories. And exactly, I mean, mind you, we've talked about, you know, mythological giants and whatnot being tied to biblical times, but how do you explain things like Sasquatch and Nessie and even the Mothman in today's current realm?
Okay, well, I actually have some friends that run the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, so I haven't researched that whole end of it extensively, but I do think it's quite possible. I mean, that there are these accounts of Sasquatch. I mean, it doesn't sound out of the realm of plausibility to me. In fact, I remember speaking to one man a few years ago that he actually had a sighting, and he ended up spending hundreds of thousands of his own dollars buying a research vehicle, and he had access to all sorts of gear and stuff like for surveillance. So, you know, he spent all of his own money after having this sighting of his own, and I think that that's something where that tells you, because, I mean, he said it was clear. It wasn't like a nighttime sighting and it was in the shadows or whatever. I mean, he said this thing was, you know, plain as day, and it was basically that. I think I have to take someone like that seriously whenever they go and spend that much money on something, and he never, ended up with any, solid results. I know that in some of the stuff he found a few clumps of hair, but he was never one to actually go forth and, you know, after spending all the money and said, oh yeah, I caught this and caught that, and then it's later on found out to be a hoax or something. So I think that there are definitely people out there that have seen something that they can't explain that does fit into the cryptozoological end of it. Quickly, as far as Nessie, I'm not really sure. I know I've certainly heard the theories that it could be like a giant eel, which is quite possible. I'm not really sure. I know that they have problems where, how much of it, if there would be enough food in the loch to feed a creature of that size or something, but who really knows?
Now, earlier you were talking about how we may not have a full understanding of our evolutionary chain when it comes to such things as creationism. Do you believe it's possible that we don't have a full grasp on the evolutionary chain as far as in general? Do we not know how many species could possibly be out there? And are we a little grandiose to think that maybe we found everything?
Oh, I definitely think, yeah, it is grandiose to think that we found everything. I mean, because the best scientists will even admit that, you know, there are holes in the theory, but the point is that they have a much more solidified theory. They have actual evidence for it. They can trace, like, the history of certain things. They can date it, you know, through carbon dating or other elements with the different strata and the layers that it was found. But unfortunately, with a lot of the creationism point of view, I know that Michael Shermer always points out about how it's basically a God of the gaps, where their answer to explaining it is that, well, God did it. Well, maybe so, but then you have to, that isn't how science works. And so whenever they try to put forth a scientific argument or present that as science, they have to actually have some evidence to say other than just, well, God did it. And so that's a lot of what the problem is between the evolutionary theory and something like creationism, where the evolutionary theory is trying to, it admits it has holes, but it's trying to put, you know, find and collect more evidence to support that that can be scrutinized by everyone, where in the creationism point of view, it's just, if there's a gap, then you just say a miracle happened.
Okay. So if man didn't come from a monkey, where did Sasquatch come from?
Who knows? Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where, I mean, they show that they had a lot of where it branched off, you know. So, I mean, actually, it's not so much that man came from a monkey. I mean, that's what a lot of people think with evolutionary theory. And I do want to stress that I'm not an evolutionary biologist. So if I'm messing up any terms or anything like that, I want to be clear that I'm not, you know, as skilled as an evolutionary biologist in explaining all of this. But basically, I mean, they can show where the different traits and things that were passed down from the generations and where they split off and the commonalities and the differences that they had in the different ancestors.
Well, you know, what's funny is one thing that they've brought up quite a bit is the density of our bones, that human bones don't seem to fit for what would be used on this planet. You know, that the density of our bones seem better adapted for a different atmosphere. It doesn't seem to fit with this. And then also, you know, with the evolutionary gaps that there are, could it be that we were visitors that came here and colonized, and, you know, whatever we brought wiped out the native species that lived here, and we became the superior race?
Oh, again, I mean, that's a possibility, but I would like to research more as far as who is making that claim and what their background is. Like, if they actually have some sort of background in evolutionary biology or just biology in general, then I'd like to see, like, their measurements of the bone density and everything, because, I mean, I don't have the knowledge of that myself, so I can't really comment on it any further. But I definitely have heard theories. I mean, I've even heard that, like, we operate closer to Mars time than we do Earth time. But again, I want to see some more serious academic putting forth that than just the idea.
All right, fair enough. I, you know, trying to tie all the different aspects of the paranormal together seems like a daunting task. What do you see are the holes in even your own theories with trying to tie this stuff together?
Well, I address that in the book. In the back, I have a whole appendix where I'm addressing some of the problems. And, for instance, one of the things, like we were explaining with the giants and how some of them are described as having six fingers or six toes. And in my research, I found that there's something that's known as the founder effect. And what happens is that whenever you have, like, a small group that migrates to different areas and they set up, and then if they just stay to their group and they start marrying within that group, then it's only inevitable that if they don't start breeding with people outside of that group, that then they're going to start sharing genes amongst each other, and then you have more likely chances for genetic deformities such as the six fingers. And, for instance, that's very common in communities like the Amish communities because they're a closed-off group. And so, you know, they have instances where the children are born with six fingers, but it's just a minor operation to remove it. But the same thing happens on colonies that, like, exist on islands and things like that. So I consider in the book that whenever we have these stories about the six fingers and stuff, it could have just been whenever it was talking about these migrating people that were coming from other regions, and then whenever the children were being born, and so then they just put forth, like, wow, he has six fingers, and that's so weird. And then these stories developed out of there and grew into the mythologies.
All right, granted, right. So it could just be the hiccups in our own gene pool that caused these anomalies, and it has nothing to do with, you know, angels screwing around with humans and and creating their own life.
I still have to be fair and address that as a possibility. But the reason why I do tend to believe more that the theory involves actual beings that were known as these angels is because, from the best we can understand, like, the ancient texts weren't science books. So they were written accounts that were put down by people that, you know, they only wrote as much as they understood. So they told us that these beings had white skin and white hair, even sort of a shining appearance about them. And so what I'm suggesting is that they didn't have knowledge of genetics and things like we do today. So why would they make up something like that, you know, that they didn't have any knowledge to support at the time? I mean, why? But yet what we know today, like we've encountered people that have they're albinos.
Right.
And so we have instances of those, which, again, could have influenced these mythologies, and then that was the case. But whenever you go back and read the text and it talks about something where the angel was fully formed, okay, and so I was thinking about that, and it's like, so wait, it doesn't need to, like, whenever its skull is formed, it doesn't need to have any cranial knitting or anything like a human baby does, because the only reason humans have that cranial knitting is because their skulls are formed in different sections so that they can fit through a birth canal. Now, what I found interesting was that there was some research of a skull that was found in Malta, which had an elongated cranium, like many other skulls, like King Tut had an elongated cranium and other members of his family. But that particular skull in Malta lacked the median knitting, and that was unheard of in medical literature. And so if we do actually have accounts of these angels breeding with humans, and they were close enough in genetic compatibility that they could breed and have hybrid offspring, is it possible that because the angel was fully formed, it was never born the way a human was, that whenever it passed on some of its genes, that, like, that skull that was found wouldn't have all of the cranial knitting like a regular human baby would because of that, because the angelic parent didn't have it?
All right, well, that's interesting. Yeah, it's there's so many questions. I mean, and do you find that the more answers that you look up, the more questions you actually end up finding for yourself as well?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I even say that
isn't
at the
maddening?
Of the book.
Right? Yeah. I mean, don't you find that maddening as a researcher to, you know, think that you're closing in on an answer only to have it kind of ripped away from you again?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that I considered putting in the book, and it was becoming too overwhelming to try and put it all in there. So, I mean, there were some things that I had to cut out or say, you know, I'm not really quite sure of this research. I need more time to validate it before I put it in. So I tried to put in only the stuff that I could verify or could come from some sort of academic source that fit in with the theories, and anything else I either just set aside for a later time, or there just wasn't enough evidence to support it, so I left it out because I didn't want to put too much in there that didn't fit.
All right, fair enough. Going forward, what do you believe? Are we going to have more definitive proof of the paranormal within the next, you know, within our generation, within our lifetime? Do you believe that we're going to see something that's going to come through and really kind of wow this, you know, wow everybody that this is what it is?
Well, I certainly hope so, at least in terms of as we develop new technologies or better theories about how the universe operates. I think that it's something where that is sort of the next realm of discovery. Like, it's something that could have been there all along, but as I was saying before, we just haven't developed the tools and technology necessary to analyze it. And so as we improve in that, I think that we will learn more about the workings of the universe and things that we just didn't even acknowledge before because we had no clue about it. And so I think that the paranormal is definitely something that we need to, you know, further investigate, and that over the next few years we will have more data to work with.
Go ahead, Tim.
Okay, so a theory on future technologies, and I've always heard this argument, but I want to hear it from your standpoint, Craig.
Mm-hmm.
Say tomorrow aliens land on the planet, okay? Now, I've heard two theories. One, society would turn itself on its own ear because it flies in the face of most religious beliefs. Two would be that we're such an oversensationalized society already that it wouldn't make much of a difference. We'd adopt it just like we do, you know, Britney Spears going out, driving around with her kids on the roof and drunk.
Mm-hmm.
The which theory would you subscribe to, and do you believe that...
Stop hating on Britney.
Do you actually believe that technologies would be unveiled to the general public? Like, let's say, for instance, let's go on the paranormal theory that the paranormal is actually another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily heaven or hell or any religious edict that you buy into.
Okay, well, I tend to believe in the latter view, where it wouldn't really, like, I mean, it would be amazing to me, but it wouldn't shatter my worldview like it would some people. So I think that, you know, people like myself could handle it, and I think actually that a majority of people could handle it. It's just that I think that there are some people out there who are so convinced of strictly their own beliefs, and they're wrapped up in sort of the dogmas of religious beliefs, that if it doesn't fit, like, if you have the aliens come here, then they're going to call them demons. I mean, you already have that happening in a lot of the research. Now, they can't really prove that. I mean, it could be. I mean, we have to recognize, yeah, they could be demons in disguise. But we don't necessarily have to jump to that conclusion, because, I mean, they could just be, you know, completely neutral, and we can't always force our beliefs upon them. So, I don't know, it's something that's difficult to say. I mean, if they went and unveiled, like, the paranormal, you know, to everyone as just another dimension, again, I think, in my point of view, that fits perfectly well with what the ancient texts told us. It's just that for so many people, they have this different understanding of the ancient texts, and that, well, no, heaven is this other place where you go to after you die. It's not some other dimension right beside us. You know, so, I mean, it's going to make them question things, and it might upset them a bit, but if that's the way it is, then, I mean, then it's up to us to just go, okay, yeah, that's actually what it was, and that's what the text described. We were just thinking about it in the wrong way.
So you believe organized religion would essentially change itself to fit whatever current theory is put out there?
Well, religion has always changed itself over the years, you know, so I think that, yeah, it would have to, because for anyone that's unwilling to do that, basically they would either destroy themselves or they would destroy everyone else just because of their unwillingness to bend. But like I said, religion itself has constantly adapted to the changing beliefs of the people. So I think that, yeah, if something like that happens, I mean, even the Vatican, you hear stories where, you know, they spend, you know, so much money on looking into the stars, and they have council meetings about, you know, if extraterrestrial life came to visit the planet, and what does it mean, and are they angels, or does the Bible allow for, do extraterrestrials exist in other planets? So, I mean, they've definitely tried to address such issues as that, and like I said, I think that it would have to adapt, or else it wouldn't be able to survive on its own.
Well, the Bible has references to UFOs throughout it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, some of the times, though, it's people take those as being UFOs. Like, I know a lot of times they refer to Ezekiel's chariot or the Ezekiel wheel.
Right.
And that's one. But I know a scholar by the name of Michael Heiser who... he's very well versed in all this, and he's definitely interested in the UFO phenomenon. He's put out books and things like that addressing his personal views of aliens in relation to biblical texts. But in cases where they're talking about, like, Ezekiel's wheel, he demonstrates how the imagery that's portrayed in there is nothing but, like, the symbolic imagery that would have been well understood by the people at that time is, like, different Mesopotamian imagery. And so there's nothing as far as being extraterrestrial about it, that you can find that same kind of imagery in some of the other cultures, but in those cultures they fill in a little bit more of the blanks, and so then you can tell that it's not actually talking about a UFO, which is sort of what I was explaining at the beginning about the Epic of Gilgamesh battling the Bull of Heaven. A lot of people, like, I've encountered stories where they're talking about how the Bull of Heaven, you know, shoots at seven weapons at Gilgamesh, and he's in this struggle with the Bull of Heaven. And so they're like, oh, those are laser weapons, and they're fighting in the sky and everything. But no, if you look at it, you can clearly tell that Gilgamesh is the Orion constellation battling Taurus, the constellation for the Bull of Heaven, and the seven weapons are the seven sisters, the Pleiades, and it also talks about Enkidu, which is his partner in this mission, and it describes Enkidu as being a shaggy-haired wild man. Well, I find it very interesting he's described as being shaggy-haired, because if you look up the etymology of the word comet, it means shaggy star or hairy star. And so whenever you put all that in context, it's not talking about some ancient battle of the gods and their flying saucers in the heavens, in the sky. It's just talking about the transition of one age into the next.
Well, we're going to take our last break for the evening, and we'll be back to wrap up with Craig Hines. You're listening to The Darkness on the Edge of Town.
We thought El Chupacabra meant the cup of coffee in Spanish.
Me llamo Eduardo Especial. ¿Cómo está el yay?
What you talking about, Willis?
Shows you what we know. Stay tuned. There's more to come from The Darkness on the Edge of Town.
If you read Taps Paramag every month, You'll be able to tell the difference between the absurd.
Could not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car.
And the creepy. Taps Paramag takes you where few would ever go on purpose. From exclusive interviews with the cast of The Ghost Hunters to the latest trends in technology in the field of the paranormal. To join our journey, order at tapsparamag.com.
Are you tired of reading about what couple in Hollywood is breaking up or divorcing? Have you ever wondered where you can find the news that covers the subjects that you are really interested in? I would like to invite you to visit SupernaturalNews.com. Supernatural News uses the latest internet technology to search for the topics we know you will be interested in reading. News of the latest Bigfoot, UFO, or Loch Ness monster sightings. Read about the latest conspiracy theories and urban legends. Supernatural News, where belief and reality merge.
The smell of voodoo hangs in the air. Either that or Dave and Tim had the seven bean salad for dinner.
Don't nobody go in the bathroom for about 35, 45 minutes. Somebody open the window.
Welcome back to the darkness, or whatever is hanging in the air, on the edge of town.
Welcome back to the show. We're wrapping up our last segment. It's going fast on us here, Craig, coming into the end of our two-hour talk with Craig Hines, the author of Gateway of the Gods. And again, just to remind people, where can they buy the book?
Sure, they can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore. If they don't have it, they can just request that they order it for them. Or they can also go to my website, gatewayofthegods.com. And I have a special for your listeners. If they just enter the coupon code DARKNESS, they'll get free shipping on their offer. With their order, and right. I'll autograph it, and they can also, there's a few other little goodies I'll throw in with their order.
All right, we like goodies. Goodies are good, so they can just go to Gateway of the Gods and order it from you, and use the coupon code DARKNESS to get free shipping, an autographed copy, and a few goodies, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and, you know, what kind of media, I mean, have you been lambasted at all by any of the other purported or self-acclaimed experts in the field by what you've come up with in these, in the texts that you've written here?
Not yet. I mean, I'm waiting for it. But, I mean, whenever that happens, if they have legitimate claims or issues with the stuff that I'm putting forth, then, you know, I want to hear it. Because, I mean, I'm not out there to just prove strictly my theory. I'm trying to put forth the best theory that I can with the knowledge and data that I have available to me. Now, I know that some people are a little put off that I criticize some other authors, but I actually don't do that in the main content of the book. I save that for in the appendices because I felt that it was stuff that I needed to bring up, because I know, just being a reader like everyone else out there, you find other authors and you think, oh man, this guy's so great. And then whenever I started researching their material more, I started finding a lot of holes in it, or that just a lot of discrepancies or things that I thought needed to be addressed that they weren't telling people, and so I became very suspicious of them, and so I felt that it was my obligation to tell everyone, because it's stuff that they can easily verify for themselves if they just take the time, but unfortunately nobody else seemed to be really bringing it up. But so as far as anyone attacking me particularly, no, that hasn't happened yet. And I really hope that it doesn't happen unless, like I said, it's regarding something that I was inaccurate in my report or theories.
All right, fair enough. Let's talk a little bit about alchemy. Now, a lot of people are confused by alchemy, what we think of turning lead into gold, things like that. What can you tell us about alchemy, and how does that involve itself with the Gateway of the Gods as well?
Okay, well, basically, like you said, a lot of people think that it's all about turning lead into gold, but again, we're dealing with symbols that they used back then to sort of pass along this knowledge, and the idea was that lead actually represented a regular human being, and that the gold was supposed to represent a divine person that was transformed into a god being. And so that was the real goal. It wasn't turning lead into gold. Those are just symbols to...
Metaphorical speaking.
Yeah.
Again. Okay.
Yeah, and so I do think, though, that gold might have played an element, like we were talking about that monatomic white gold. But so basically, you find time and time again this whole idea of turning the lead into gold or to square the circle, which the idea was that the square represented earthly matters or the earthly realm because it had fixed dimensions that were easily calculated, but the circle had infinite possibility, and so it represented heavenly things. And the idea was, in squaring the circle, was that the area of a square and circle were exactly equal, which sounds easy, but whenever you study mathematics, you know that that's technically impossible, because to find the area of a circle requires the irrational number pi, which goes on forever. We've never found an end to it, and there's no repeating sequence that we can detect. So you can only know the approximate value of the circle. And so that was part of the problem. You could always calculate the approximate value of equating the square and the circle, but it was never precise. But the ancient riddle was trying to equate the two, and I put forth in the book that what it meant was to reunite heaven and earth based on what those symbols represented, and to also transform humans into these godlike beings, that was our next step that we had to take ourselves and to prove that we had what it took to move to the next realm.
Now, are you planning any follow-ups for the Gateway of the Gods books? I mean, is this something that you continue to educate yourself on and look at the different theories? Do you even think that you're going to follow up and do more on this?
I would like to, and I always continue the research, but I'm not going to put forth anything until I have much more solidified research or something that I feel is worthy to be put out there, because I don't want to just put out a book to put out a book or to try to make money or anything like that. So I do want to continue the research. I have been continuing the research, but whether or not there will be an actual follow-up book, I can't say at this time. I was planning on it, but like I said, as you study and research, certain elements fall out of favor in the research, and so you have to go back and constantly reevaluate your material. But at the very least, I do plan on continuing the research and putting forth updates or things like that regarding it.
What field right now, Craig, is kind of grabbing your attention? If you had to say your research is going in a certain direction, where would it be going?
Well, one of the things that I was interested in was with the remote viewing. And I know there's a lot of controversy surrounding that, but what I was also noticing was a lot of sort of parallels between the remote viewing aspects and some of the medieval claims about different things and some of the alchemy books that were written. So I was starting to investigate that area, but I really don't know how well that's going to fuse together.
Okay. Now, you said that you had a pretty high level of interest in the paranormal, the ghost hunting things. What experiences have you had with ghosts? Have you done that yourself?
I've gone on a few investigations, not nearly as many as I'd like to, though, because I'm usually so preoccupied with I have a couple different jobs and then maintaining my websites and everything like that. But I've been on a few investigations. I know I was at in West Virginia, the one penitentiary there, in Moundsville, and I did catch an anomaly in the camera, but honestly, I think it was more of a camera glitch, because as we were explaining before, that I think the shutter, because it was dark in the room I was taking the picture, and that it was dark, and I think that the shutter was left open a little too long, and so I got a little bit of a ghosting appearance from the camera moving while at the time I took the photo. And as far as any other personal experiences, there was one many years ago, where it was more like I was having some odd dreams, and then it seemed almost as if something sort of came out of the dreams. But it really, I can't go any further than saying it might have been something like just a hypnopompic hallucination. And so, since I don't have any data, I can't put forth anything more than that.
With the advent of all the information and everybody that's, you know, getting into the paranormal field, do you think that there's, you know, that all of this attention can also be bad because, you know, of what you've alluded to through here, some people get so zealous about their thoughts and their beliefs, and we see it all the time how people, you know, have their own feeling on what is paranormal and what is not paranormal, that they don't give up easily even if they're proven wrong?
Oh, yeah, I think that is a problem. Because, you see, and that's something, too, whenever I was trying to write the book, I was trying to be as neutral as I could about it because I think that's the right attitude to take, because I have encountered people where they'll get into arguments with me, you know, about something that's in the Bible. And I say, well, no, that's not in there, or I'll tell them that something is in there, and they'll tell me, no, it isn't. And then whenever I press them a little further, then they tell me that, well, they only read the New Testament. They didn't bother with the Old Testament. You know, so they still were telling me that I didn't know what I was talking about, but yet later on, whenever I pressed them about it, they say, well, yeah, I didn't read that part. So, I mean, yeah, it is kind of bad whenever people, they find a lot of things to fit their own beliefs. And we're all guilty of that to some extent, but we have to constantly, like, evaluate the data and evaluate ourselves and how we're looking at the data, because that we definitely put on a filter while we're looking at those things. And so if we can't recognize our own biases and things like that, then we're going to believe anything that we want to believe. And so somebody else might have a completely different theory, which might be correct and yours isn't, but if you don't want to believe it, then what good is it? You know, you're lying to yourself.
Who did you read most when you were doing your research? Who would you recommend people read if they want to flesh out more of the details? So you try to bring everything together, you know, and make it linear so that it follows through the entire book. But if people want to flesh out any specific different parts of your book, who would you recommend that they read?
Well, as far as from the biblical point of view, I would have to say Dr. Michael Heiser is the best. I don't always agree with all of his views, you know, particularly with, like, the aliens and things like that. I mean, I think he put forth definitely a very good theory within his books, but I don't necessarily agree with it. But he is someone that I deeply respect. I consider him a friend, and he definitely knows his material. Now, the interpretation of that is where I have some issues, but that's just my personal belief. And then besides that, I don't know if I can recommend anyone in particular, just that people can get all sorts of academic resources to study these things for themselves. Like, I took it upon myself to get Akkadian dictionary so that I could actually look up the word for myself. Because, like, whenever I read something, for instance, a lot of people always talk about Zechariah Sitchin. And I used to be a fan, but then as Michael Heiser's pointed out a lot of issues with his stuff, I started looking at it and going, you know, he's right. And so then I started, you know, getting the dictionaries myself, like the Hebrew dictionaries, the lexicons, the Akkadian dictionaries, the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionaries, and looking up the words for myself and just looking at whether or not what, you know, somebody like Sitchin was putting forth, whether his theories were actually supported by what the texts were saying or if he was just imposing more of his beliefs on there. And so what I tried to do was just say, you know, let the texts speak for themselves and then see if it fit with the theories I was putting forth, and it did. And in other departments, it's really hard to say because the book, I covered so many different authors in there that they all have a piece of the puzzle, so I don't know if I can recommend any other ones in particular.
Okay, so just kind of read through it and see who you have referred through the book.
Yeah.
As having read. Okay. Well, you know, Craig, our time is up. We've had a great time with you here tonight. We certainly would love to talk to you again. I look forward to seeing you out at Eastern State Penitentiary and having you do a talk for us there. And that'll be taking place May 1st through the 4th. We do have that event up. You can, for all the listeners, you can check it out at darknessevents.com. We'll be going back to Eastern State Penitentiary, where we're going to investigate two nights with Jason and Grant, Chris Fleming, Patrick Burns, John Zaffis, and you'll be hearing some fascinating talks by guests like our guests this evening, Craig Hines. Craig, I wish you a lot of luck with your book.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you again for inviting me to be a part of the Eastern State event.
Oh, we appreciate it, and we appreciate everybody tuning in this evening. And again, if you want more information on the book, you can go to gatewayofthegods.com. Again, that's gatewayofthegods.com, or you can check out the book anywhere at, again, the author's name, Craig Hines, H-I-N-E-S. That's Craig Hines with Gateway of the Gods. We're going to be back next week with another new show, so make sure that you stick with us. We look forward to having you back, and thank you very much. Tell your friends about Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Burn it, put it on CD, send it to them in an email, let them know that we exist. Let's spread the word and help spread the darkness on the edge of town.